I mean, also, if you think you're going to look under the bed in a perhaps a messy room and you see something that's sort of striped and pink, you don't automatically think lizard, do you? I don't. You don't.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to another New Year's Eve, or is it New Year's Day, edition of TMR. Each year, as regular listeners will know, we are visited by the Fireside Nephilim Boys of Like Flint Radio for a sort of half light-hearted and half serious chat about things that entertained us or irritated us over the last 12 months. And this year was going to be our third session. However, due to considerable technical difficulties, we tried to record that session, but this year I'm afraid the Fireside has unfortunately had to be abandoned. However, all is not lost, because we have decided to split what would have been a mammoth chat involving about half a dozen people into a series of interviews involving fewer people, which should be far more manageable from a technical point of view. And today is going to be the first of those, and hopefully we shall be joined by a few other members of our secret society later in the programme for a word or two and to share in a toast to the new year as the clock strikes 12. And so today we are joined by two members of the Nephilim Boys secret society, Frank Johnson from the USA of the Ancient Aliens Debunked Facebook group, and formerly of ancientaliensdebunked.com, which has for some reason or other ceased to be for the time being. No doubt we'll get into quite why that has happened in a minute. And Cruzy from South Africa, who is one of the official crew of Like Flint Radio, which is a great Christian podcast emanating from the Southern Hemisphere and most often hosted by Garth Kennedy in Australia. And if you don't know that podcast, then do check it out. I do recommend it. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us on TMR.
Good day, Julian.
Thank you, Julian.
It's a great pleasure to speak to both of you. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on after all those technical problems that we had last week trying to get that recording done. It's good of you to come back on and try again. As I say, we're not going to be doing a normal fireside session this time, if you can call it normal. I'm not sure you can call it normal anyway. we're going to be centering our conversation in a subject that you were going to touch on, Frank, but I guess we'll have more opportunity now to go into it in more detail. The subject of Planet X, or Nibiru, or I don't know what else it's been called over the years. So if anybody doesn't know about this, it is a, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Frank, I'm trying to summarize, it's a hypothetical planet, or perhaps a twin to our sun or something like that, which advocates claim is part of our solar system, but which is hidden and not officially acknowledged to exist by the world of science for one reason or another, whatever that reason might be. I think, is that basically it, would you say, Frank?
Well, I thought we were talking about dinosaurs building the pyramid.
That was last time.
Oh.
You had your opportunity, Frank, and you blew it.
Oh, okay. You're right. Yeah, people. I mean, it depends on which theory you're looking at and who is talking. Planet X Nibiru, or any other number of a few other names, is either a hypothetical planet out there, like a brown dwarf or some other kind of Jupiter-sized planet, or even possibly a star of some sort. I mean, I think it's more traditionally thought of as a planet. It could be like anything up to like a Jupiter type of planet, like a brown dwarf or something smaller and rocky that, you know, we just can't see or whatever. Yeah. The myth of that comes in a variety of different shapes and flavors. So,
yeah, the other aspect of it is that it's hidden. It's maybe known about but kept secret, something like that.
Yeah, a lot of people claim it's covered up, you know, like NASA's covering it up, or this group or that group is covering it up. And
well, that's a fascinating aspect of it that I'm looking forward to getting into. Anyway, Frank, how has life generally been treating you since we last spoke properly, anyway, when we did that Ancient Aliens interview?
You know, it's been a little bit better. Moved to a more settled down place. you know, into a house out of an apartment. So that's good. And, you know, just now waiting and hoping for the job situation to stabilize. But other than that, it's slightly better. So that's good.
Good. And you're writing a book on the debunking ancient aliens idea. That's based upon your blog, isn't it?
Yeah, basically, a couple of people had asked if the blogs were available in print at all or in a book or anything. And at that time, I didn't have enough content to put into a book. And I was like, well, no, they're not. Maybe one day. And since the blog is gone now, all the blogs I had written aren't really up anymore.
Right.
I figured, you know, I don't want to just put them on another website or another blog. I can put them into a Kindle book so people, you know, can get them like really cheap. And also it allows me to do a CreateSpace book at kind of the same time. I have that available as like a print resource in case somebody wants it for family or friends who don't use the internet much, or just to have on the shelf in case they ever go offline again. So,
right. And you can actually buy the Kindle book in advance, can't you? I mean, I've done that. but there's nothing there to read at the moment. Is it, as you update it, people who've bought into it get the latest version. Is that right?
Well, when you bought it, what did it give you? Did it give you anything? I'm curious.
It just gave me a receipt.
Well, there is actually, I was going to just publish it with just the one blog I had edited right now, which was the Mana Machine. Right now, I actually, instead of just publishing it and doing a blog here, a blog there, I actually put it on for a pre-order, at least till I get a few blogs up there with a publication date of about 90 days out. And hopefully I'll have enough content edited by then to put it out. Basically, I'm not writing any new material for this necessarily. It's just kind of taking the blogs from the Ancient Aliens debunked site and just editing them, adding footnotes, looking at some of the hyperlinks, and because some of them don't work anymore, sadly.
I do recommend that people buy into that, because I think your blogs are very interesting. They should be read. And I think as a book, I think it would be great to have a copy of it. So do buy into that, people. As I say, in, is it 90 days or something, there should be some content that starts to be delivered to your Kindle account, and it should grow from there.
Yeah, I think it should be about March, is at least I should have to publish. Otherwise, Amazon will probably take me to the woodshed. But yeah.
So what happened to the ancientaliensdebunked.com website?
The short answer is I don't know. So
okay.
What happened was, because I have not really been in touch with Chris White, who ran the website. You know, he's got whatever he's got going on. And I was just contributing blogs to kind of get people in to see his movie, or just kind of as supplemental material. Somebody on the Facebook group said, hey, you know, the Ancient Aliens site is down, right? You know, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Not again. Because we had actually been hacked quite a few times in the early days of the website. So I went to look at it, and the site was
Politics of Religion.
Thank you. Yeah. Politics of Religion.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, I'm like, this is weird, but it sounded familiar. And I remembered something from Revelations Radio. It had been something Politics of Religion. And I think now when you go to ancientaliensdebunked.com, it redirects you to the YouTube movie.
That's right.
So my theory is, and I haven't confirmed this with Chris, since he hasn't been so active with his podcasting or whatever, probably what happened is the website came up for renewal, and it just, you know, it doesn't make sense to keep it up because it's not really generating enough money to keep it up with ads or donations or whatever. You know, he just had to probably just cut his losses and just buy a redirect to get people to the movie, which is really at the end of the day what most people probably were coming there for anyways.
And as you say, if you get your blogs into that book, that won't be lost, and people will be able to access it that way. Cruzy, I think of you as the man who posts extremely cheesy jokes on Facebook, but you're so good at it that I find myself laughing nearly every time I read them, no matter how cheesy they are. So where do you get all these jokes from? You have so many.
All over the internet. I must admit, I do cheat. I do read a lot of them on the internet. They're not all mine. In fact, most of them aren't mine.
Really?
I just choose to repost them and give people a giggle a day.
Well, I'm glad you do. It's very amusing.
Just for the fun of it, you know.
Yeah.
My image of you is crushed. I thought your jokes were so cheesy because your parents were dairy farmers.
not quite. You know, everyone finds their niche somewhere on Facebook, and I did not have anything interesting to say like Frank Johnson and those guys. So I just thought I'll do what I can and just make jokes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've got a couple of favourites here that I picked out from your threads. One is here, last night I ate 4 bowls of alphabet soup and then had a massive vowel movement. I love that one. And the other one is, if carrots are so good for the eyes, how come I see so many dead rabbits on the highway?
Exactly. Well, talking about the alphabet soup one, there's another version of that one that says my next bowel movement could spell disaster. please do not try and picture that one. anyways,
it's, they really are very good. Oh, dear. Excellent. Well, I'm very pleased to have you on the show, Cruzy, and I'm looking forward to a few of those as we go through this subject matter today. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that you are interested in Planet X.
Oh, yeah.
I presume you've never been an advocate of the theories, though, have you?
No. Well, I've got a couple of friends that are very New Agey, and I've heard their version of the whole thing. You know, I've heard so many theories by them. You know, it's hiding behind the sun. Mm. It seems to be intelligent. It's broadcasting radio waves, this and that. And there's never any solid proof of it. So, yeah, it's nice to have the Christian perspective as well from Frank and Joe Jordan and those guys. So I'm just interested in the subject, but I wouldn't call myself an expert like Frank.
Okay. Well, let's turn then to the expert.
Oh, wow. The pressure is on.
It is. So we're centering what we're going to say today in this article that you wrote, which has got a great title, Our Wacky Solar System, Planet X, and the Theories That Love Him. And you basically split this discussion into two parts, level-headed questioning and research into the question of Planet X. And then you had more fringe writing on the subject as your second section. So let's, I know we've mentioned it before, but just remind us, what's the broad picture of what Planet X is about?
Okay, so there's, as you said, there's a couple different ways to view it. One was like a hypothetical planet that was theorized way back before we had good telescopes and stuff. So the guy who discovered, he didn't discover Pluto, but he had actually photographed Pluto without knowing it. Percival Lowell was his name, and he's famous for canals on Mars, or at least popularizing them back in the early 1900s, maybe, or late 1800s. Mm-hmm. You know, aside from that, now a silly theory of the canals on Mars, he took a lot of photographs of the night sky and photographed a lot of different asteroids and Pluto. And I think he was the first one who had theorized that there was something wrong with Neptune's orbit or something that made him think there was another planet out beyond Neptune that was large enough to disturb Neptune's orbit. When the planets are orbiting, they can kind of tell there's another planet around it because the gravity from that planet will kind of affect the others around it. So when the planets are passing each other, they kind of make each other wobble, or they can detect it through different ways, you know.
So that was an entirely scientific enterprise there. Mm-hmm. He thought there were these effects upon Neptune that required some explanation, and he theorized another planet because of that.
Yeah, orbital perturbations, he called it. He thought, okay, there's another planet out there doing it. And that's what his theory was. And he called it Planet X because, you know, X stood for unknown. He didn't, you know what to call it because he didn't confirm it was actually there. He just theorized it was out there. Since then, when we sent Voyager out there, they determined that his calculations about Neptune's mass were wrong. And once they got a better reading of the mass, or, you know, discovered that Neptune's orbit was not actually having these disturbances.
Yeah.
So,
but nevertheless, that research sparked interest such that later Pluto was discovered. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least, maybe people were looking for Planet X. And I think Clyde Tombaugh was his name, discovered Pluto when he was maybe looking for Planet X, or just was like just observing the night sky. Not quite familiar with his discovery. I should be, but yeah.
Hmm. Okay, so that's Percival Lowell. He was an astronomer, but he was also other things, wasn't he? A businessman and a writer and things like that. But he was a serious astronomer, wasn't he? He was doing science.
Oh, yeah.
But then Planet X received a different name and some different hypotheses. It became called Nemesis, according to some researchers. What was that all about?
Yeah, so the Nemesis theory was in the 80s. It didn't really have anything to do with Percival Lowell's stuff, because I think by that point they had already kind of dismissed that theory. But they had kind of tweaked the idea of another large planet or object out there. And What had happened was they thought in the fossil record every so many millions of years that there were mass extinctions. So they didn't have really any explanation for that. And so they hypothesized this thing called Nemesis. I'm not sure why they called it that, but basically this Nemesis would be a planet or maybe small star, brown dwarf, that would travel through the solar system on a highly elliptical orbit. And then as it passed through the Oort cloud in the outer solar system, it would bring comets and other space debris with it. And as it passes into the inner solar system, those objects would crash into Earth and cause these mass extinctions. And that's kind of similar to Zechariah Sitchin's Nibiru theory. So I think he probably had his theory first, Sitchin did, but these guys kind of gave it some scientific, like, unintentionally probably. But
yes. Although with Sitchin, it was a planet, but this, you say, is a brown dwarf. I'm wondering whether, Cruzy, we could turn to you for some clarification on what a brown dwarf is.
That might come over racist. Are we allowed to say things about colored dwarfs?
I don't know. I mean, I can only say, well, a brown dwarf is whatever it is.
Not in America.
His name's not happy, that I can tell you. On a serious note, brown dwarf is a small star or something. I'm not sure. Frank will have to clear that one up.
Is that right? Is it a small star?
Kind of, yeah. It's like a bigger Jupiter that's kind of a failed star. Big gassy planet that's not quite a star, but it's like really hot, but not like hot enough to become a sun, yeah.
And it does emit some level of light. Is that right? But not a lot.
Not really. It's more heat than anything. Not really emitting much, if any, light, yeah.
Like most politicians, it doesn't emit a lot of lights.
And it's full of gas, hot air.
Yes, it's full of hot air and gas. I've got it.
Right. Okay, so we've got this politician coming into the solar system every now and again and causing all these extinction events. And then it gets called Tyche. why is it called Tyche all of a sudden?
Well, so what happened was the supposed Nemesis theory, they actually figured out that these mass extinctions weren't actually happening when they looked at the fossil record or things like that. More closely, they discovered that, hey, this Nemesis theory is not actually needed. Uh-huh. Yeah, so they kind of threw that theory out, but they still kind of thought that, well, maybe there is still another companion star or object to our sun, because the statistics on this one are like way out there. It's like between 40 and 80% of stars, known stars in the galaxy, supposedly have a binary companion, meaning they have another star in the solar system. I couldn't find a solid number on it, but it's pretty high number, 40 to 80%. And so they were like, okay, well, the sun probably has one too. And so they called that Tyche or Tycho, I'm not sure which, because it's just this theoretical, maybe a brown dwarf star kind of sitting out there on the edges of the solar system. Uh-huh. There was somebody who actually recently came up, and I haven't really blogged about this, but there was some objects in the Oort cloud or the... what's that other thing out there? That's another belt. Kuiper belt. Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. These objects were disturbed or something, or their orbit was kind of clear. I don't remember the article, but he was saying that, you know, there might still be a planet out there undiscovered, but he didn't really tie it into any of this Planet X. So even today, there's like still some people out there looking for a planet that's maybe out there. And the Tyche one is kind of maybe the hypothetical brown dwarf companion star to the sun that we just haven't observed because it doesn't emit any light.
Okay, so is it right to say that this has not actually then been ruled out by the scientific community?
It hasn't been completely ruled out, but there's a podcast I listened to and actually referenced quite heavily in this blog. I think it's called Exposing Pseudo-Astronomy. He has actually a whole series on all the different Planet X claims and theories, which is why I used it heavily in this blog. But he said that NASA and all these other scientists have done massive scans of the, you know, known universe and have basically concluded that there's no brown dwarfs or similar type of companion objects to the sun within like millions of miles. And basically, it's pretty much a certainty that there's no brown dwarf companion, because we do have the capability to see it. Actually, I found the quote here. To quote, there are no brown dwarfs in our solar system and no binary companion to the sun. And if there was, it's more than 10,000 to 26,000 AU, that's astronomical units, away from Earth. And it's not on any orbit that would come into our the inner part of the solar system and do anything. Because if it was, you know, the asteroid belt would be disturbed, and it's not. They referenced the WISE telescope, W-I-S-E.
I looked that up. So that's the, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which is a telescope based in space itself, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is. And it's up there too, so it doesn't get as much interference from Earth.
Yeah. So that would pick up, you say it would emit a lot of heat, so the infrared would pick that up.
It absolutely would, yeah. And the quote they have is, observations with the WISE telescope have ruled out the possibility of a Saturn-sized object out to 10,000 astronomical units and a Jupiter-sized or larger object out to 26,000 astronomical units. And so at least a brown dwarf companion has pretty much been ruled out up to that far away. And for anybody who doesn't know, an astronomical unit is the distance of Earth to the sun. So that's 93 million miles. So
it's a fair way.
So... Yeah, that's pretty much a certainty. There's nothing out there, at least like that. There may be still a small rocky planet, but it's not on any way going to bother us.
Okay, well, you say that. So we can rule out the binary star kind of option, but we can't rule out the planet option. And the subject that we're discussing strictly is Planet X. So it is still possible that there is some extra, or perhaps a number of extra planets out there. But what about the idea that that planet comes in every few thousand years very close to Earth as part of its elliptical orbit? Is there any scientific basis for saying that's a possibility?
I would say not, because one of the arguments people are going to use is that it's coming from the southern hemisphere, so it's kind of perpendicular to the plane of the, you know how all the planets are kind of in on one plane, they're sort of kind of all level with each other. This planet is supposedly kind of on its own elliptical orbit perpendicular to that, so people always say you can't see it because it's coming from the south. However, as Cruzy can probably confirm for us, anywhere in the southern hemisphere, you can see the entire night sky. Right. You don't have to be at the South Pole to see everything.
Depends if you're a flat earther or not.
All bets are off if that's the case.
That's what I was going to say. We know that's not true because Earth's flat, and you can't have a Planet X coming in if it's just a dome covering us. So that's pretty much the bunch right there. End of show. Let's wrap.
Exactly.
That was a more simple theory, certainly.
It certainly would solve a lot of Planet X problems, for sure.
Occam's razor. So there's also the possibility, is there not, that it is out there, and NASA knows that it's out there, but they're lying about it. What's your reaction to that, both of you?
Frizzy, do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I would just ask, why would they?
That's an excellent question. What's the motivation for this? Yes.
That's a good question. I don't. People would say that NASA is trying to cover up, the creationist worldview, and also, depending on who you ask, the hollow Earth or the flat Earth or any number of other things. You know, they're Illuminati, they're Masons, they're just doing it because they like to cover things up. I don't know. They don't. You can never get a good, clear answer on that, and you absolutely can never get any evidence for it.
No. I was racking my brains about it, and the only thing I could think of was that if they were covering up this supposed fact, then it would be because they know that it's going to cause havoc when it comes in on its elliptical orbit, and they want everybody to be protected from this information because they don't want society to go into chaos. That's the only
That's actually the only logical reason I've heard, which kind of doesn't make any sense, because what advantage would they have? If they knew it was coming, they could all just get in their bunkers and just hide and wait it out and just let us all live our lives and not even pretend to put on a show. And, you know, it's like if you had secret knowledge that this was coming and you wanted society to continue, just pack up and go, you know, go to your bunker and just wait it out. I don't see any motivation to keep up the pretense, you know.
Unless, I suppose, they want to continue to have their, you know, rather nice lifestyles in the meantime, continue to enjoy their research, etc.
I suppose, yeah, that's kind of a really really risky gamble, I guess. But hey, I guess that may be part of the fun. I don't know.
No, I was thinking about this, and although I think that, you know, in isolation is an explanation that at least makes some kind of sense, it still doesn't entail that particular planet exists. Basically, you know, it's a sort of counterfactual thing, isn't it? You're saying, well, if that exists, then NASA would cover that fact up. So just because you've got an explanation of why NASA might cover something up doesn't mean that the planet exists. So it doesn't really get you anywhere.
Mm. Yeah, and I can tell you how any average person can basically debunk this themselves, the idea of the planet coming in and causing havoc in the solar system. So the orbit of the asteroid belt is actually so stable that, like, they can track it back to a hypothetical, you know, millions of years ago. So if you want to give them millions of years, they can track the orbits of these asteroids back at least that far. If you're, you know, young Earth and you're diehard about that, if they can track it back millions of years, the math is good for a few thousand as well. So, I mean, they can see that these orbits of these asteroids are stable. So if anything came into the inner solar system, it would have disturbed those asteroids and we would see the evidence of it. And there is no evidence for that ever having happened. So
right, there would be that signature in the stars, so to speak.
Yeah, there would be.
And that neatly takes us into the more fringe angle on this, because we have this chap called Zachariah Sitchin, who you have in the essay as basically as the villain of the piece. And he suggests that this planet that he calls Nibiru, and we'll get into why he calls it Nibiru in a moment. Anyway, he suggested it has this 3,600-year-long elliptical orbit around the sun, which is goes quite against what you've just said, that it would come in and it would disturb everything, go out again, and, well, there would be some evidence of that, wouldn't there? Anyway, so do you want to tell us about Zachariah Sitchin and why you've got him as the villain of the piece?
Yeah, I think for me, he's the key villain of this because he came up with the theory of this 3,600-year orbit and kind of took, you know, those science-y versions that we just talked about and kind of added sort of a weird angle to it in that he claimed there were aliens on it. And his whole reasoning for coming up with this theory was that he had supposedly translated these ancient Sumerian and maybe even biblical texts and claimed to have found proof of this in ancient writings, that there was a planet of the crossing, Nibiru, and it came every 3,600 years to cause problems in our inner solar system and go back out. And there were aliens living on the planet X, Nibiru, that comes in, and they enslaved people and had a mine for gold and kind of like added all these extra strange theories onto it.
Yes, yeah. Can I double check some of these details, what I found out about this? It may be wrong, but, you know, you're the authority on this, Frank, you can tell me. So these are the aliens on Nibiru who he called the Anunnaki, which are the godlike figures, I understand, of Sumerian and Babylonian religions, that kind of thing. Anyway, he said they were aliens on this planet. And as you say, they wanted to have some slaves for gold mining. Don't quite know why they're interested in gold mining, but apparently they were.
I'll tell you.
Okay. And so they, when this Nibiru got close enough to Earth, they came to Earth and they combined alien genes with Homo erectus. And that's where we Homo sapiens actually come from. We were made as workers for their gold mining efforts by this genetic engineering, by the Anunnaki aliens who came to Earth. Have I got that right?
That sounds like pretty much his theory in a nutshell, yeah.
Okay. Right. Do we have any reason to believe what he says?
I don't think so. I mean, for a couple of reasons. First, he's not an expert in ancient languages.
But he claimed to be. Is that not right?
He did claim to be, yeah. He claimed to be. And actually, Dr. Michael Heiser had actually, I don't know if he still does, but he had a website called Sitchin is Wrong. Heiser actually does speak the languages and or read the languages that Sitchin claimed to be an expert on. And Heiser basically picked apart almost every claim Sitchin made and pointed out why it was wrong linguistically. And so I think just from his linguistic standpoint, Sitchin's work just doesn't stand up when you read Heiser's work. Just from his translations, it's absolutely nonsense, you know. Then you get into the other aspects of what does a planet look like with a 3,600-year orbit? I mean, it's near the sun every 3,600 years. how are they surviving in deep space for 3,000 years, you know?
That's a good point.
Yeah, and part of that comes back to the gold mining thing, is they use the gold to power their atmosphere machines and keep an atmosphere, but that's like basically magic, you know?
Why would you use gold for that purpose?
Yeah, it makes no sense. And while it does explain how he thinks they kept their atmosphere on their planet or whatever, it doesn't explain how they can survive without a sun for that long, you know? So I don't know. There's a lot of holes in his theory, just if you think about them, how does this actually work kind of thing, you know?
I was just thinking, if they have to keep gold on hand for 3,600 years, wouldn't it make more sense just to jump off and inhabit Earth? And all their problems are solved.
You'd think, yeah.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. It's a very good point. It's a much nicer place to be, isn't it?
So they're probably not the smartest aliens either, then.
No.
Yeah.
And I was going to say that Sitchin himself was a smart chap, although he wasn't an ancient languages scholar, because I understand he had a degree in economics from the London School of Economics, which is a pretty prestigious place.
I didn't know that, actually. That's new to me.
Well, so I read.
Maybe that's why he's like, he has a degree in economics, and he's like, what's the way I can make the most amount of money? I know, I'll write a book about weird.
And about gold mining as well, yes. Yeah.
I don't know. That's really interesting, though.
Well, maybe it's not true. Sometimes these read things on the net and they're not true. I don't know. Perhaps somebody can research that out there and find out whether he did in fact have a degree in economics from the London School of Economics. A little quote here from Mike Heiser, as you say, who is a PhD in ancient Hebrew and ancient Semitic languages. I mean, he wrote this paper on the supposed evidence for Sitchin's Nibiru, and he calls it the myth of a Sumerian 12th planet, Nibiru, according to the cuneiform sources. I've just got this little quote here. It's this conclusory paragraph, just to say a few things from it. Quote, what do the cuneiform texts tell us about Nibiru, particularly in contradiction to Zechariah Sitchin? Here's the list. 1. Nibiru is called a star. 2. Nibiru is called a planet, nearly always Jupiter, Marduk, but once Mercury, and never anything beyond Pluto, all the known planets. 3. The Sumerians, by their own records, knew of only 5 planets, and accepted the Sun and Moon as planets. 4. Nibiru is never mentioned in any respect with the Anunnaki. It is never said to have been or be inhabited. 5. Nibiru is both a fixed star in some relationship to constellations, whether a member or just in proximity is unknown, that holds them in their courses, but it is also described as changing position and crossing the sky at times. 6. Nibiru was seen every year, which demolishes Sitchin's view of a 3,600-year cycle for it. End quote. So pretty much most of it debunked.
Yeah.
Just there. By somebody who really knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and the good thing with Heiser is he actually published his credentials on the website. He put up his tax returns to show that he works in the field, and he, I think, put up scans of his degree or whatever. So it's like he provided his actual credentials, whereas Sitchin just kind of never did. And I think Heiser even challenged him to a debate. And unfortunately, I think Sitchin died before that could ever happen. But I don't think Sitchin was interested to do it. So
jump to that, no.
No.
There's another person you mention who I think is very interesting, given the recent conversation that we had with Joe Jordan on the alien abduction phenomenon. Very interesting. And this is a lady called Nancy Leader, who I believe popularized the idea that Nibiru is on a collision course with Earth sometime later this century, I think. And who claimed to get this information from aliens via an alien implant in her head.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very intriguing. Can you tell us a little bit more about this lady, Nancy Leader?
Yeah, what I know about Nancy Leader is that she became kind of popular in the early 2000s, maybe the late 90s, mainly with the internet and I think some internet chat rooms and her website Zeta Talk, I believe it was. And you said that was still up, but
it is.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got a nice juicy quote from that. I'll read in a minute.
Okay, sure. Basically, on the Zeta Talk, she was getting these messages from aliens, supposedly, and now the messages she gets from these aliens are not like you and me talking. They're supposedly telepathic. They're not words specifically, because apparently these aliens, the gray aliens, don't actually talk or think like we do. All they can do is give her images. And so that kind of gives her an out, because when she's giving us their messages, whenever she makes a mistake, she can blame it on not being able to understand what the aliens are communicating, or them not understanding the pictures enough to communicate it properly. So she got this information that, you know, the Nibiru planet thing was coming in, that it would be coming in like 2003, and it never actually happened. And she also claimed that it would cause like a pole shift and all these other catastrophes that never actually happened. So right there, I mean, that should tell you quite a few things, that she's getting false information, and she's either making it up or like getting false information from some sort of entity, you know, as Joe spoke of in his interview with you. And actually, interestingly enough, her gray aliens are supposedly the same as like all the other ones, except her ones communicate differently. So it's not really clear why her ones can only communicate one way when everybody else's gray aliens can communicate telepathically with words like we are talking now. So it's kind of, you have some contradictions in the alien abduction narrative there. But anyway, you had a quote on that?
Yeah. I was just thinking that you were saying she could be lying, or she could be influenced by, certainly from our Christian perspective, we would say, you know, demonic entities would be deceiving her.
Yeah.
When I went to ZetaTalk.com, it said that she gets a lot of this information by hypnotic recall. So if she goes into a state of hypnosis in order to, in inverted commas, recall what has happened to her, then it could well be the case that she does in fact believe this, but is being deceived. That would suggest that to me.
Yeah, definitely. She could be, you know, as you say, under demonic oppression, or, you know, getting demonic messages, or even as simple as like the person putting her under hypnosis could just be suggesting like these ideas to her, and she may be susceptible to whatever somebody is telling her. When you do hypnosis, you're at a minimum opening yourself up to suggestion. And, you know, when you're hypnotized, you're kind of giving your will over to that person hypnotizing you. And, you know, you're trusting that they're going to not put bad thoughts in your head, you know, but you just don't know, I guess. So, and alternately, you could be opening yourself up to, you know, demonic deception, in that these demons could be implanting false memories in you, or you could be making your own false memories. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities there. So if she's remembering all this under hypnosis, I mean, there's just no reason you would want to trust in that, because I can't think of any reason any of that would be reliable.
It's all internal to the person.
Yeah.
And again, in inverted commas, evidence. We're not dealing with anything that anybody could reproduce evidentially for themselves. And this comes out very clearly. And this quote I've got here, the whole thing about alien abduction and the internal quality of this hypnotic recall. This is a quote from her bio. Nancy became aware of her contactee status in 1993 and the potential for being a communicator of the Zeta message. So this is the aliens from Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah.
In the midst of a full life with a family and a full-time job, as a contactee, Nancy participated in the hybrid program and met one of her hybrid children. In preparation for her communicator role, Nancy was given life form instructions and introduced to MJ-12 at an early age. Now, I tried to find out who or what MJ-12 is, but it wasn't quite clear.
Oh, it's Majestic 12, yeah.
Oh, you know. Right, trust you, Frank, you know.
Yeah.
Go on, what's Majestic 12?
Well, that was supposedly these documents found off the top of my head in the 50s, probably like in the 60s maybe, or 70s, where they were supposedly government documents detailing the government's UFO evidence and programs. They're controversial because their authenticity was never truly really established, and I think since 2000 something they've actually been recognized as very clever hoax or something like that. I'd have to do more research into that, but that's what I remember, yeah.
Okay. Well, it gives me more of an idea of what it actually means. I'll just finish the quote. Nancy expends her retirement time and money on getting the Zeta Talk message out. Requests for interviews take top priority. And I'll just add that she is still giving interviews. I looked at her schedule. She quit a professional job in California in 1999 to move to Wisconsin to walk the talk. Born in Wisconsin, Nancy returned to her grandparents' homestead, where she first met the Zetas in the woods as a young girl. So this seems to go back a long way in her experience. There she gardened, saved seed, raised chickens, and tried to be an example of how people should prepare for the coming changes, as the Zeta talk message is threatening to the establishment, who fear the populace will panic. Nancy deals with a lot of flack. End quotes. So there's a very much a new agey feel about that. Coming changes to the world. And, well, yes, it does seem to me anyway, this influence of evil spirits, you know, visiting her even as a young girl and leading her along this path, which unfortunately she has pursued.
Yeah, I agree.
That's the way it seems to me anyway. But of course, it's difficult to prove any of these things. But I think the takeaway from that is that nothing that is said there is in any way something that you can trust at all, is it?
No, I would agree with you. At a minimum, a very clever story. But yeah, it sounds to me more like she's kind of wrapped up in some sort of, you know, demonic deception. Yeah, like many other abductees, unfortunately.
I've got a quick question. I don't know if you were going to get to this topic later on, but just for interest's sake, I've seen Christian prophecy websites trying to draw parallel to the star called Wormwood in Revelation 8:11.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What would you say about that?
Funny you would ask that. Julian, are you ready to move to that part? Because actually that is part of the blog I covered.
Indeed. Well, looking at my notes here, this connects with a guy called Gilbert Erickson. Is that right?
One of several, yes. Okay. But for sure, him. Actually, this is one thing that I thought of when I first started hearing of Planet X and this whole Nibiru thing and something's coming. I actually started to get kind of scared about it. And it's just because, you know, in the Bible, it does talk about Wormwood in Revelation and how the star crashes to Earth and all that. Mm. On the surface, without getting too much into Erickson, I think when you look at the book of Revelation first, there's a lot of stuff going on that's, it happens literally, but it's kind of described symbolically, I think, at least my understanding of it is that real things that are happening spiritually too. Doesn't make sense, real things happening spiritually, but...
No, I agree. It is very difficult to interpret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do get some very vivid imagery, which when you get into Second Temple Judaistic symbolism can sometimes have a much more spiritual message than it would seem on the surface.
Yeah.
So I do agree. It's very difficult to interpret some of these things. Can I just read that little bit about Wormwood there from Revelation so that everybody's on the same page as us here?
Yeah, please.
This is Revelation 8, 10 and 11. This is John recalling his vision here. And the third angel sounded, and there fell from heaven a great star burning as a torch, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of the waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, or bitter, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. Okay, so that's the quote. And just looking at it on a surface level, it looks like you've got an astronomical object that falls into the oceans and turns them bitter or perhaps poisonous, something like that.
Mm-mm.
So there seems to be a kind of, on the face of it, warrant for thinking that it is something astronomical.
Sure. And
well, if I,
go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, if I can just say something interesting here. There could be a different explanation because the word wormwood comes from the Greek absinthos. And the word bitter there could also be translated as angry. So you could theorize that anything falling into the waters of the earth causing cataclysmic damage, you know, could be seen as angry waters.
Mm.
So the bitter part might not just mean bitter as in taste bitter, but angry.
Sure. I think your theory there, Cruzy, is interesting. Maybe I'd like to hear you explain that a little bit more. But one of the things I noticed in Revelation, the imagery for stars are very often angels, are they not?
Yes.
Or at least interpreted as angels. Mm-hmm. In my memory, like whenever a star is mentioned, it's like, you know, when Satan, the great dragon, casts like a third of the stars down from heaven, that's to be interpreted as angels. So very consistently in Revelation, I've seen or at least believe that stars are very often and mostly angels. So one way I have always interpreted Wormwood was as an angel coming to earth from heaven. Now, I do kind of agree. It does look like it could be an astronomical impact of some sort. I can see why people would have this viewpoint, because you also have in the Revelation a burning mountain falling from the heavens or whatever, doing something with the waters. And so, I mean, you could interpret it like that. But when you start to interpret these things in Revelation that are very, they are literally happening, but there's also a lot of spiritual things going on with it. So if you say this is just a normal, genuine, you know, space rock that's out there now, a comet or an asteroid out there doing these acts in Revelation, you're basically saying it's something that's out there now that we could hypothetically like track the orbit of. We could potentially observe this thing. If it was on a collision course orbit with us, that means it's out there now on its way here or away from us. And by the time you observed it, you could see it coming to Earth, and then you would be able to set a time for when this stuff is going to happen, which we know you can't know the time, you know. So I think although these do sound like physical things happening, and maybe they are, I don't think you can say they're just a conventional astronomical object.
Right.
Like, you know, in Kings where Elijah's calling fire down from heaven. That sounds like an astronomical object, but we know it's a supernatural manifestation of God's power. So here in Revelation, where you have this imagery, if we are talking about a physical thing happening and destroying things, I don't think we can say it's like an astronomical object. I think it has to, would have to be like something that's supernatural and part of God's judgment.
If there's one more interesting thing that I can just mention here, Revelations 8:11 that you quoted now, talks about people dying from the bitter waters. Now, often in Revelation 7:15 says it as well. The waters that you saw where the whore sits are people and multitudes and nations and tongues. Water is often a description of multitudes of people. It's possibly not literal water, but just multitudes of people.
Yeah, I think I agree with that in some way. Because, yeah, when you think about... didn't they say the beast came from the sea? And when he comes from the sea, that's interpreted as the multitudes of people, right? I remember.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So I think actually Cruzy's interpretation would be one I've never heard before, but it actually makes a lot of sense to me.
It makes sense with the notion that sea also represents the world in opposition to God, the sort of chaos oceans. Because, I mean, in Revelation 21, it says, when the new heavens and the new earth come about, there will no longer be any sea. And I've heard people say that that means there will no longer be any world disorder in rebellion against God. So again, this all points to that symbolic use of waters and sea as being the peoples and the creation in rebellion against God.
Yeah, I'd actually, Cruzy, like you to maybe send me your thoughts on that. I'm not going to steal it or nothing, but...
stick it in your book.
No, I'm totally not going to steal it, so...
The overall image is one of judgment, isn't it? I mean, it fits into the judgment schedule. And I found a reference back to Jeremiah, chapter 23:15, which talks about wormwood. Therefore, thus said the Lord of hosts concerning the prophets, behold, I will feed them with wormwood and make them drink the water of gall. For from the prophets of Jerusalem is profaneness gone forth into all the land. So it could be an image of judgment in general projected into the New Testament corpus there, which fits with everything we've really been saying about this more spiritual understanding rather than, as you say, necessarily an astronomical object. And certainly there is no justification for concluding that this is proof of an astronomical object, is it? I mean, that really is tenuous to the nth degree.
I think that's another case of what's happening with this whole ancient aliens theory is that we're looking at these ancient texts and, you know, the Bible in particular here through a modern lens of a space age lens, you know, and that's where you start to run into problems.
Okay, well, we've just been talking about this chap, Gilbert Erickson. I think you say in the piece that he's kind of, I think you used the expression shoehorning the Planet X stuff into biblical references. But this seems to ratchet up when we talk about other people. I mean, you have particularly this guy called Gil Broussard seems to do this even more. You have some other names, Doug Elwell, Mark Coombs. But particularly Gil Broussard, you say that he goes to quite some lengths, really, to do this sort of thing. And he sees Planet X as responsible for a whole load of things, like Noah's flood, Babel, Sodom and Gomorrah, the reign of Joseph, Exodus, even Job's troubles. What's going on there? How does he manage to make these connections to Planet X?
He kind of just cherry picks or seems to cherry pick these different biblical events and essentially claims that like Planet X, and he actually calls it 7X to kind of differentiate it from the fringe theories because he thinks his theory is real. He calls it 7X or P7X, so take that for what it is. And yeah, he basically blames that for all these, you know, catastrophes in the Bible, like, you know, the famine during Joseph's reign, various droughts during the Bible, like even so far as going to say that the drought during the book of Ruth was somehow caused by Planet X or 7X. The destruction of the Tower of Babel, which is not actually recorded in scripture. He picks that from the legends of somewhere anyways, where they said that the Tower of Babel was burned with fire. And that's not in any biblical source that I'm aware of. Sodom and Gomorrah. The list goes on down the line, really. I mean,
has he established some kind of cyclic repetition with this so that each of these events is equally spaced in time or something like that?
And that's where it gets kind of funny, is like his transit time for Planet X is not 3,600 years. He was saying that that is partially right, but it's actually a 360-year orbit. And in my previous writing, his orbit of that has an error rate of giving 30 years or taking 315 years. So it could be every 330 years to 600 something years. So he basically makes it come whenever he wants within that large window of time.
Pretty close as well.
Yeah.
That would be easily observable, I would have thought.
Yeah, if it was here every 360 years, I mean, you would have real evidence of this recently, like as recent as the 1700s. I mean, and there was...
records, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that I'm aware of in the 1700s that was recorded, because he said, I think Planet X was due here around now.
Does he claim perhaps that it no longer exists or that it's spun off into outer space or something?
No, his PDF is no longer available online, actually. Right. He did date set to a certain extent that it was supposed to be here. It was like, he said, Earth's looming next near-miss encounter with Planet 7X has a high probability to occur sometime in the year 2013 through the end of 2016. With special biblical emphasis on March 25th, 26th of 2016. He was like saying it should be visible in the sky by a certain point in time, and that time has since passed.
So it has been coming in and going out ever since biblical days, according to him.
According to him, yeah. And the funny thing is the times he gives for these events in the Bible, like, I don't think any serious scholar actually puts those events in the Bible at those times.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he just kind of pulled numbers out of nowhere. So.
All right, so this is obviously false.
Yeah, and I would say given that and the fact that his PDF is no longer available online, I think he's probably been outed because he had like no real qualifications. And I mean, not that I have any myself. But,
but the fact is, if it's been coming for all these years, ever since biblical times, then there must be record of it, and there is no record of it, presumably, and so therefore we know just based on that this is just false.
Yeah, and he claims the Bible is obviously record of it, but I mean, if you really examine those claims, they fall apart pretty quickly. If it was coming in now, we would see the other planets reacting to it coming in. Their orbits would be different. Things would be happening that anybody could observe, and NASA could not cover it up. So yeah,
unless of course, Frank, it is a spiritual planet. If it can pass through walls, perhaps it could pass through planets and asteroid belts.
It's like the planet of the weeping angels from Doctor Who. It's like, you know, it's coming in, and then when you look at it, it stops and kind of disappears. And
you can't rule it out, Frank.
You can't rule it out. You absolutely cannot. So
Okay, well, this is a last question to both of you, really. What do both of you think we can learn from all this? And I'm thinking both of Christians and non-Christians. What should our reaction, would you say, to all this be, and what can we learn from it?
I would just say be careful of speculation. It always seems to be snowball into something unmanageable. Yeah, just be careful of speculation. That's what I would think. Let's stick to what we know, which is what the Bible says. Stick to the basics.
Indeed. Frank?
Yeah, I think I have maybe a few takeaways from this. So, I mean, number one would be do your own research and don't be afraid of science. You know, I mean, there are certain claims within science. Obviously, we don't agree with necessarily, but largely, I mean, they're observing things that are happening now and can be verified by other scientists. So don't be totally dismissive of all things science. Just because somebody, you know, with a lab coat said something doesn't mean they're covering it up, you know. Don't make up wild conspiracies where there aren't any, you know. And if you don't believe what a scientist is saying, do your own observations and prove them wrong. I mean, you can become an amateur astronomer and watch the movements of the planets yourself, and you'll see if Planet X is coming yourself. To sum that up, I would say Act 1711, everything, you know, hear everything with an open mind, but kind of research it for yourself and make your own judgment and make a sound, wise judgment. God gave us brains to think critically with. Use your brain to think about things. I think the other thing I would take away from this sort of thing is don't interpret ancient texts, and especially don't interpret the Bible with a space age or modern lens. You know, the Bible especially interprets itself in almost every case I can think of. You don't have to assign it astronomical events where maybe none are happening, you know. The third thing, the last thing I would say is don't be afraid of these wild conspiracy claims, because at the end of the day, God is in control. You don't have to be afraid of Planet X or whatever, because if you really look at Revelation in particular, that's, you know, God's wrath on an unbelieving world. It's not for believers. So even if Planet X was a real thing being used as God's judgment, we don't really have to worry about it because we're not going to be here, you know.
Yes, indeed. I totally agree with you. And perhaps do a little bit of proper research when it comes to these things like Revelation, where you're dealing with extremely difficult things to interpret, really. Best to go to the scholarly materials first, and then you're better armed, aren't you, to then go, if you wish to, these more speculative things, and you can make a proper judgment about it.
And that would be maybe my last and final thing, is if anybody, just from a prophecy standpoint, is saying that a prophetic event is happening right now, and these are the seals of Revelation, or this event from Revelation is happening or has happened, you know, use, again, your common sense and your critical thinking and read through the seals and kind of really understand what's going on there. We didn't really touch on it here, but when I dissected Gilbert Erickson's stuff, you know, I looked at the seals, and once the seals are opened, they're opened and they're all going to open really quickly, and it's going to be the end of the world, and it's like, whatever. So you can't say one's opened in World War One, which is what I think Erickson was claiming, and the Rwandan genocide was one of the seals. It's like, you can't, I mean, why that 100-year gap? I mean, absolutely. You know, yeah. That's what I mean to say. I'm not trying to scare everybody. It's like, okay, you can't say that World War One is one of the seals and that the Rwandan genocide is still that seal and part of the next seal being opened. It just doesn't make sense, you know?
I know, and if people want to follow up on that, then they really need to read your essay, which unfortunately, as you say, is not online, but you have agreed that it could be posted as a text file, something like that, that could be downloaded by people. I did suggest putting it up as HTML as a page, but it's so huge, it is about 30 pages long, that it would take me a very long time to edit that as HTML. So I think what I'll do, and you've given me kindly permission, I'll put it as a text file, downloadable, and then people can read, particularly the second part of your essay, where you go into this kind of thing in much more detail. Really interesting stuff. Thank you very much, both of you, Frank and Cruzy, for coming on.
Thank you, Julian. I always enjoy talking to you.
I hope that you're going to stay with me now for the New Year's Day toast a little bit later,
which
we are indeed fast approaching. I'm not sure who's going to be joining us on Skype in a few minutes from now. I think we may have Mark Campbell. We do indeed have Mark Campbell from the UK, who is developing into something of a roving reporter for TMR, having interviewed James Burke for us a while back, whose second cousin's daughter's former best friend, Uncle Campbell Adams, appeared on the show earlier this year to speak about Yandling. Welcome to TMR. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Julian. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure we're all very much looking forward to what you have to say. And I believe you have a number of things that you want to share with us from the news over the last year. But before we get to that particular set of interesting things, perhaps you could tell us where you are. I know that you're normally based in London, but I think you're somewhere else today.
Yeah, well, today, funny enough, I'm actually in the Mariana Trench.
I don't know that. What is that?
The Mariana Trench, which is one of the deepest parts of the ocean. It's sort of between Japan and Papua New Guinea. So I'm actually down there at the moment.
You're actually down in the ocean at the moment?
Yes, so that's why the sound quality is probably not brilliant, is it?
Yeah, it is not at all good, no. And the strange thing is, I think I can hear something like police sirens or something in the background? Oh. Just sort of give the impression that you're not where you claim to be.
No. Now, the thing is, it's quite lonely down here, and I do miss London, so I've got a little tape recorder next to me, which is playing sound effects of London, just to remind me of, well, there we go. There's one of them. Can you hear it?
I can hear something.
Yeah, there we go.
It sounds suspiciously like an ocarina or a recorder or something. So.
Well, it is. It's a recording of it, you see. So that see, keeps yes, me. Yes. So you've proved my point. Yes.
Right.
It sort of keeps me grounded, if you like. No pun intended.
What are you doing down there? Why are you there?
Everyone's got to be somewhere.
Well, that's certainly true.
You know,
why are you there rather than somewhere else?
Because I kind of like to travel around, and I've never been to Mariana Trench before, so thought I'd give it a go, really.
And how are you managing to breathe?
Oh, well, I'm in a bathyscope, which is one of those things with a hole in the bottom, and it keeps the air pressure inside. So I've got enough air for about another hour or so.
Right.
So hopefully we'll be done by then.
I hope so. Yeah. Presumably this costs quite a bit to arrange.
It's huge. I mean, absolutely. Cripplingly expensive, yeah. But I thought worth it. Yeah.
Well, it's a great shame from the point of view of our recording here, as I'm sure everybody else will agree, because it's quite difficult to hear you at times. The signal is quite poor. And I suppose there aren't too many satellite provisions down there.
There aren't any satellites under the water, no. Oddly enough, no.
No.
No. No. And it is quite deep. It's one of those, if you've seen the Blue Planet, you know, they're always finding strange things underwater. So you never know what you're going to find and how deep it goes.
So you're just another strange thing to be found under the water, I guess.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark, I know you have these things that you'd like to discuss with us from the year. So what is it that tickled your fancy during the year?
Well, a fairly recent story, actually, was, I think you've seen it yourself, about this man who had his head cemented into a microwave.
I did see it, actually. Yes, yeah. You put it on Facebook, didn't you?
Yeah. And what they said in the news story was that the microwave wasn't turned on. That was okay.
Yeah.
He was an internet prankster, a YouTube prankster. Mm. As I understand it, he'd used the microwave as a sort of box to then put cement in and then to put his head inside. And then he would remove the microwave and his head would be in cement. I don't know why, but I think the cement just dried very quickly inside the microwave and he was stuck in there.
Right.
So they had to call out the fire brigade and chip the microwave off and get him out. And he survived. I mean, it wouldn't be a funny story if he died, but
no. The
fact that he survived makes it very funny.
But that was only because he was rescued. Otherwise, he would have suffocated.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he was doing it on his own or something, that would be... But he had some people around. But you just think, have people always been this stupid? Or is it an internet thing?
Oh, I suppose it's a warning to everybody not to do this specific thing,
no,
isn't it?
Yeah, because microwaves, you kind of think they're dangerous things. But even if the microwave's turned off, if you're actually going to introduce cement and then your head in a microwave, it's dangerous. Yeah. I think people should, you know, you should sort of make people aware of that.
It's a public safety issue, isn't it? Yes.
Exactly. I mean, I did once try this thing where, I'm not recommending this, but if you put a glass of milk into a microwave oven and put a light bulb into the glass of milk and turn the microwave on, it will make the light bulb glow.
Oh, right. Okay.
But it also, unfortunately, what it also will do is break the microwave, as I discovered. I'm going to buy a new one.
I see. That's another thing not to be done. Okay.
Exactly. So don't do that.
One of the great things about this was actually reported by the BBC.
Yes.
And that, to some extent, that's beginning to redeem the BBC in my estimation, because there's so much, I think, is fake news on the BBC, but here's something that seems to be really quite worth reporting on.
No, I agree, and they've got their facts right on this one, and it's a pretty open and shut case, isn't it, really?
Yes.
There's also another story in the BBC about some people had to call the RSPCA.
I think I need to explain that for our international audience.
Oh, right.
The Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
Exactly. So there was a family in Coventry, where's Coventry? Up near you, isn't it?
It's in the Midlands, isn't it? Yeah.
Midlands, okay. Yeah. And the family there thought there was a dangerous lizard under their bed. So they called this RSPCA and the officer came along and it turns out it was a dirty sock.
Right. And this was, again, a BBC story, wasn't it?
A BBC, yes, absolutely. They were very embarrassed, apparently. Mortified, the spokesman for the RSPCA said of them. It was a pink stripy sock, 7 inches long, 2 inches wide. And there is a picture of it on the website for verification. And it is a very dirty sock.
It seems very incredible to me that the people wouldn't have noticed that it was, in fact, a sock. I mean, why wouldn't you get close enough to it? I mean, why would you be so scared of a lizard? My experience of lizards is that if you get close to them, they run away anyway.
Yeah. I mean, also, if you think you're going to look under the bed in perhaps a messy room and you see something that's sort of striped and pink, you don't automatically think lizard, do you? I don't.
No, you don't actually. You automatically think sock.
Yeah, well,
right?
I think you automatically think sock, yeah. But yeah. I mean, but then you do wonder, are these people doing it, you know, just to be an internet meme or something? I don't know.
We are in those days. Yeah. Where people are indeed claiming their 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol famously said. Yes, indeed.
I know.
And anything else? I think, do you have a third one at all?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's a slightly more serious one, I suppose. Walt Disney recently bought Fox Empire, Rupert Murdoch's Fox. Right. Was that too serious?
No, that's fine. It's just that you said Walt Disney bought it, but I thought he was long gone. But
I see. No, his head is still, he's in cryogenic, frozen cryogenically.
Okay. Right.
So they do, I'm sure, I think they do sort of go to him sometimes, a bit like that chap in Dark Star and ask his advice on things.
Oh, right. Oh, I see.
They unfreeze him momentarily.
Like Jeremy Bentham, the philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who
is stuffed
and brought into a university college for various meetings in a glass case.
Well, I don't think Walt Disney's stuffed. I mean, he's stuffed with his own organs, but nothing else, I don't think.
Okay, right. Gosh.
It's an easy mistake to make, because when I said Walt Disney, I meant the company Walt Disney, not the dead person who started it. Yeah. So they've bought one empire, bought another empire. So this is an enormous media conglomerate now. And if you look at all the things they own, it's incredible. Yeah. But looking at the story, one of the things that Disney currently owns before it bought Fox was a channel called Vice. Now, that sounds a bit, doesn't exactly sound like it fits in Disney's ethos, does it? Vice.
It doesn't sound it. No,
the description of it is, it's called Viceland, is the new TV channel from Vice. So Viceland is a channel of personal perspectives. Hmm. We're here for music, food, sex, fashion, tech.
Right.
All the things that make up life, which I'm sure you and I agree is absolutely all that makes up life, isn't it? Especially tech.
I'm not sure it's all of the things that make up life, but it's part of what makes up life, yeah.
Well, that's what it says.
Okay.
So there is a program, for instance, called, I don't know, are you going to bleep me or shall I just not say the word, the rude word?
Say it and I'll make a decision later.
All right. Well, it's a very rude word. That's delicious. This program chronicles the life and eating habits of rap's greatest bon vivant, Action Bronson. Right. With the help of his friends and collaborators, Action shows us that life is to be enjoyed as much as possible. And that's okay. The name of the program.
And this is owned by Disney, who we associate with all those nice family films.
This is owned by Walt Disney, Bambi, Cinderella, Snow White. Ah, lovely family films. There's a program called Bon Appetit. Take a cannabis-fueled culinary journey in search of bold flavors, colorful characters, and truly high-end eating. As Bon Appetit travels the world seeking out those with a passion for food, weed, and merriment. Now, I don't know whether this is postmodern or not, but it's pretty awful. But Disney already owns this. Disney already is the parent company for this channel.
It certainly smashes that rather squeaky, clean apple pie kind of image that they have, indeed. Yeah. Yeah, so they're just a corporation like any other after all, yes, of course.
Exactly.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, I mean,
and, of course, they bought Star Wars as well, didn't they? That was the end of them when they did that. I mean, fancy buying something like Star Wars. I mean, I've never been much of a Star Wars fan.
Oh, I think it's a very good thing they bought Star Wars.
Uh-huh.
Well, you must have seen The Phantom Menace.
I think I did, yes. I saw a couple
So I rest my case. I rest my case. I mean, they've got nothing could be worse than that. So
Was that the one with a lot of main characters standing in some boardroom giving one-line deadpan performances?
Yeah, well, those first three film prequels were essentially actor standing in front of green screen delivering dialogue. Yes, Jar Jar Binks was in Phantom Menace.
That's right. It was pretty awful, wasn't it?
So yeah. There we go. But yeah, it's just a company like any other, and I think when you start looking at who owns what, it's quite eye opening. Mm. Yeah, I don't know what the seven head would Walt Disney would think, but there we go.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your Bowler and Fez film review YouTube channel, suddenly going great guns. I mean, it started not that long ago, just a couple of reviews, and now you've got dozens and dozens of reviews on there. Are you happy with the way it's going?
Oh, very much, very happy. I mean, I'm looking at ways to push it further because I think more people should. I'd like more people to sort of to know about it, really.
Yeah.
Currently, it's coming up to about 100. It's about 100 reviews on there.
Wow.
Do you want me to tell you a bit about it?
Okay. Well, I was just going to be really basic about it. You can add in the details. I mean, it's basically make a film review about whatever film it is that you're doing, and you don't go into great detail about it. You simply choose a venue, and you stand there, and you either put a bowler on or you put a fez on your head to say whether you essentially like the film or not. Is there anything more to it than that?
No.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes I stand, sometimes I sit down.
You do. That's true.
Yeah. I mean, I did start sitting at my desk in my study doing it, and then fairly quickly after that, I decided to broaden out the canvas. And also, bear in mind, the reviews are only approximately 30 seconds long, of which the first 15 seconds is just the title music. So the actual review is seconds.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's all you need. The whole point of that is it's all you need. It's a bowler or fez. I mean, it was suggested to me, why don't you put a bowler and a fez on if you're not sure? But that's not the point. The point is I have to be sure. It's one or the other. It's binary.
Right. So let's just be absolutely clear about this. For somebody who's not seen your reviews, they go to your YouTube channel and they click on whichever film they're particularly interested in, and they will find this. Half of the review is the introductory sequence. And then they will see
which
you...
I sing the theme tune and I play it on my theremin as well.
It's very good, actually. And then they will either see you sitting, lying, standing, whatever, in a venue that is either suitable or perhaps contradictory to...
No. For instance, I reviewed the film Paddington 2. Now, outside the O2 where I live, there is a statue of Paddington that's been put there to promote the film. Mm. So I could have sat next to the statue of Paddington and done the review, but no, of course not, no.
Right.
I sat next to Paddington and did a review of some awful horror film. No, I don't want to be appropriate at all, no, because then I think you get hidebound by trying to think of a venue that suits the film, and the whole point of it, the venues don't.
So it's not something deliberately contrasting, it's just that it's not connected to the film.
Exactly, disconnected.
You don't actually say it. Well, you do say...
No, I don't.
Well, in a philosophical sense, you do say by using the bowler or fez, but you don't pronounce any words, do you?
No, in a sense that, you know, the watch tells you the time, but it doesn't tell you the time.
Yes, that's exactly right.
In a philological sense, that's not a Anyway. Sorry, it's a lack of oxygen is starting to take it back, you see.
We haven't got very long until you keel over.
No.
So you make your decision, and then you just stand there until you see the copyright mark.
Yes, essentially. Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
And you have a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Tomes, who has put a comment on the YouTube channel.
It was very kind of him. He did comment on one of the videos, and I've kindly used it with his permission. Sheer duration is not a sign of profundity.
Sheer duration is not a sign of profundity, yes, indeed.
Which I think is quite something to think about.
Yeah.
I've done one on a boat. I've done one, a dog came and influenced one of my decisions. Done one in Greenwich Park. Lots and lots of films. I mean, I'm open to requests.
And what films have you done? Tell us more of the films you've done.
So I've done Star Trek films, I've done Marvel films like Doctor Strange, Disaster Artist and Battle of the Sexes are the two films fairly recently. Bridge on the River Kwai.
You did The Sound of Music, didn't you?
I did, and I think you disagreed with that, didn't you?
I do disagree with that, yes. I think it's very...
You would have given it a fez, wouldn't you?
I would have given it a fez, yes. I was horrified to see that you gave it a bowler.
You were horrified.
I was horrified, yes.
Well, the thing is, you see, because in the circles I belong to, it is quite revered. I mean, you can sing along A Sound of Music and stuff. So it wasn't as if I was going for a trendy option. I think I was sort of swimming against the tide.
No, I see. Well, it's just that most of the people I encounter say they don't like it. For so many years, it was on every year on BBC television, wasn't it? You know, at Christmas, particularly. And people got really fed up with it. But it was not on for quite a long time. And then when I came back to it fresh, I thought... Actually, this is a really good musical, really good material, and it was a very well done film. And I thought, this is pure prejudice just because people have been so exposed to it over the years, you know.
Yeah, possibly. But then you said, I avoided it studiously until I decided to watch it once, and then I didn't like it. So
right.
It's not as if it was always on and I was getting fed up with it. I bow to you in the musical stakes, but I just thought in terms of the story and the tweeness combined with a sort of Nazi seeking them out, it just seemed a bit, it didn't really work for me tonally. I thought it was a little bit all over the place. But then it's a very personal opinion. That's the beauty of these.
It certainly is.
The first few reviews, I put Fez's for a good film, a Bowler's for a bad film. I suddenly thought, no, who's to say what's good and bad? So a Bowler is for a film I don't like. Fez's for a film I like.
I see.
Obviously, anybody is welcome to disagree with me. So it's a free world, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people, you say people can actually send you requests as to which film to do?
Yeah. I mean, if you just put Bowler or Fez reviews into YouTube and you'll come up with a channel, so by all means, drop me a line that way and or comment on a video and send me a request for something, and I will, if I haven't seen it, I will do my best to see it. If I have seen it, I will post a review.
That's excellent. And you have quite a few followers now, don't you?
I'd always do with more. I've got a handful of subscribers, but if you want to subscribe, you know, anybody listening, that would be fantastic.
Absolutely.
Because that way you get, you know, informed of all the new reviews that come up. And I'm pretty, what's the word? What is the word? Oxygen starvation. Yeah. When you produce a lot of things.
Tired?
Not prestigious. Prodigious. Tired. I'm pretty tired of doing the... Mental block on this word, but I do a lot of reviews anyway.
Right.
So I'm making up for lost time.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me say then to TMR listeners, do in fact go and subscribe to that channel. I'm sure you will enjoy what Mark does. I enjoy it very much. I think it's very amusing. And it would be great to see that YouTube channel become more popular indeed. I think it could become quite a cult thing, actually.
Yeah.
I hope so. Well, good to have been speaking with you, Mark. Thanks very much for dropping in like this. You did mention that you might like to share a prediction with us for 2018. So if you do have a prediction to share with us for the new year, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Just to let you know, I've got a couple of minutes left of oxygen before they winch me up. So, yes, prediction for next year. What I'd like to see next year is I went on a little adventure earlier in the year driving in my Mini from Manchester to a place called Skegness, which is on the east coast of Great Britain. And I passed over a little toll bridge there. Everyone knows what a toll bridge is, don't they?
I hope so.
Same in America and wherever.
I hope so. Where you pay to go across the bridge?
Yes. So it was in the middle of nowhere, and I had to get out the car and try and find the money, and got back in and paid the little man. And it was 40 pence for this toll bridge. Not very much. So I think what I'd like to see next year is perhaps to have toll pavements. So if you were walking down a road, you have to pay tolls to go from one road to another. Walking will be good.
Right.
I think that'd be entertaining.
This is instead of the state paying for the roads and the pavements.
Yes, exactly.
So everybody makes their contribution individually.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Runners and Olympic runners who also have to pay is when they run around, pay per 100 metres as they ran. You'll make it much more entertaining, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for your wish for the new year. I'm not quite sure that it's a prediction, but... It's certainly a wish. Anyway, thank you ever so much, Mark. I think we better end that there before you suffocate.
Thank you.
I hope you're going to be winched up in time to reach the surface. Good to speak to you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And now there is no time to waste as we are fast approaching that golden hour of 12 on this New Year's Eve. And I can see the second hand ticking its way towards the vertical position here as I speak. So I think we had better get ready to celebrate our toast to see the new year in. And just like last year, I have again splashed out and bought another expensive bottle of Laurent Perrier's Grand Siècle just to mark this very special occasion. So without more ado, I shall try to ease this cork out of the bottleneck. A bit tough, but there we go. sorry, Cruzy. Oh. Did that get you?
You got me.
Oh, Frank, sorry.
No,
I apologize for that.
I ducked.
You ducked. Excellent. That's probably the best thing to do under the circumstances. So if you would please pass your glasses towards me, I shall pour. Cruzy.
Thank you.
Frank.
Yeah.
Mark.
Yep. Oh, lovely. Thank you. Yes, that's enough.
So if you'd all raise your glasses, my good friends, let's clink those glasses together and welcome in the new year. Happy New Year to all.
Yay!
Happy New Year!
To the New Year!
To
the New Year! To the New Year! To the New Year!
To the New Year! To the New Year!
Oh, that's delicious. Thank you.
And Happy New Year to all TMR listeners who've tuned in for today. Happy New Year. I do.
along in the dark. A sailing milk mustache, and like the red, white, blue, don't let the sun get up on my mustache.